You're listening to Red Setter, your roundup of Red Camera news from the crew at fxguide.com.
Hello and welcome to this week's Red Center at FX Guide. I'm Mike Seymour, joined in the studio by Jason. How are you, mate?
I'm well, Mike. How are you? You're sounding well.
I'm sounding better. I'm sounding better. I had a good weekend. Did you have a good weekend?
Coughing your guts out. Yeah, very good. Pretty relaxed.
I took my 70 to 200 for a play on the weekend and did sort of sports photography with it. And boy, that was a joy. 1/8,000th at fully open at 2.8.
Fabulous.
Shooting really narrow depth of field where I swear to God it was like an effort to get that that Canon to autofocus in time, but I had a ball.
Fantastic.
And we have a lot of news this week and a lot of stuff we're going to get through. So let me just explain what's going to happen this week. We're going to do a couple of amazingly cool things. We're going to start with some news and run down on some of the stuff. We're going to answer a few questions from last week's, and we're going to be doing part three of our four-part series on Red Workflow. And then, Jace, we have a pretty interesting interview lined up.
We have rather amazing. I think it's probably, definitely, no contest, our first Academy Award winner on the show, I think. We are speaking to Anthony Dodd-Mantle, who won the Academy Award for Slumdog Millionaire.
And, Jace, we were discussing this, weren't we, you and I, the other day, that we obviously started Red Center and do have a big bias towards red, but in fact, we'd like to be able to think of ourselves as covering a large range of digital cinematography issues.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
It's particularly the case with Slumdog Millionaire, which, of course, wasn't shot on the red.
Yeah, although, I mean, obviously Anthony has shot with the red before, but this was all done with the SI2K, as everyone knows. But yeah, look, there's just so much stuff out there. We just can't let stories like this go, and Canon 5D and what's happening, you know, every time you turn around, there's something new. I think, yeah, we sort of want to expand the horizons and start not just talking red, really. So, yeah, it's renaming. Rebranding.
Well, no, just making sure that you guys are comfortable with our sort of more slightly more expanded domain of interest. So let's get started with the news.
Okay.
And now, the Red Setter News.
Okay, well, the first item here is, now we're not quite sure too much about this one here, but the DVS has announced the Clipster, which is essentially accelerated red workflow piece of kit. I guess this is sort of a larger, more expanded version of what we're going to expect with the Red Rocket.
Yeah, the Red Rocket is has its own use, and we'll get to that in 1 second. But yes, the idea here is that you have a real-time performance from somebody doing a dedicated solution, though this is not the same exact technology that's being used in Red Rocket.
Or the same price point.
No, true, but it is shipping now.
Yeah, that's true. Although, okay, next news would be take us through to Red Rocket anyway, which is which we sort of thought would be not too far away, but Jim has officially announced that it will be 2 months until we see Red Rocket. So it'll be fantastic. In the meantime, we're waiting for other stuff. We're actually going to get have the ability to at least get some benefit from acceleration via Red Rocket while we're waiting for new gear with higher data rates that need more acceleration. Red Rocket 2.
3, 4, 5. Actually, sort of semi-related news. We had an interesting time dropping in at that Red user group, didn't we?
Yeah, that was cool.
Though we managed to time it to arrive 2 minutes. Actually, I say we timed it. I timed it. I buggered it up. maybe do you want to explain? I'm too embarrassed.
On the way to... I was driving Mike to the Sydney Red user event. Primarily, obviously, to go there to looking at, you know, with technical information in mind, looking at some screening of some footage, talk to DP and a grader, and you know, obviously, sort of, you know, see what we can glean from the conversation. On the way there, Mike announces that as part of the lighting discussion that would happen, there would be a burlesque model as the lighting subject, which sort of sweetened the deal a little bit, of course, although we were going there for purely professional reasons. And then Mike got a phone call saying he had picked up somebody else's keys, and within 5 minutes...
Now, that's a completely reasonable thing for somebody to do. I should just point out, hasn't anyone else...
Oh, absolutely. I've never done that.
Right, okay. Anyway, the point of the long story is short is we arrived 2 minutes after the burlesque dancer had finished her masterclass.
Well, we arrived 5 minutes before, and then we had to turn around completely, go back across over the Harbour Bridge on a Friday night peak hour traffic, and by the time we come back, we missed the burlesque dancer altogether. So, but yeah, it was some very good. It was a great night, and there's more to come. Mike, I believe you're speaking at one coming up.
Maybe, yeah. That's the kind of hope. Actually, kind of plan, yes.
Okay.
I don't know, it's a physical, you know, I don't think it's sort of locked in yet, but yeah, that's the idea.
Excellent. Okay. But no, it was a great night. It'd be great to see some more support there as well. Not that there wasn't many people there, but it was great to see a good turnout. And so we will definitely try to keep you in touch with more of those coming up. And obviously, if you've got a Red User event in your part of the world, let us know. We'll definitely put the word out for that. Next little item is the extreme panic on Red User, when somebody who obviously had got a few close-up shots of one of the DSMC modules at NAB had noticed the terror, the horror of mini XLR audio connectors on the I/O module and the in-out module, and basically, obviously, someone said, "Oh my God, what am I seeing? Mini XLRs, they suck." Which is, you know, yeah, it's true, but. Then Jim hopped on there and said, basically, look, obviously there's three options. There is going to be three options for the in-out modules, or the three options for getting audio in. Firstly, what everyone was looking at and panicking about was the what they call compact I/O module, which has mini XLRs and has a CF reader in it. So it's really sort of a little all-in-one sort of run-and-gun package. The what we have seen before for the in-out module with the full XLRs is the Pro I/O module, which doesn't have a card reader but has timecode, dual link SDIs, and full-size XLRs. So you're going to definitely have options. The third option is if you really don't want to, if you just want to put a card reader on but still get sound in there, all of the modules apparently are going to have little 3.5-inch, equally, you know, the sort of not great technology, but they're all going to have 3.5mm mini jacks on the front of the brain.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the fact is that I'm enthusiastic that there are these range of modules coming out. I guess the question is, like, what's going to come first, and when that comes first, you know, what's going to happen? But to be frank with you, I think for a bunch of people, if you're shooting with stills in mind, you definitely want the card reader. But if you're not shooting with stills in mind, maybe, you know, you don't need the card reader.
Well, I mean, a part of the joy of this little camera, you know, is that you can just sort of strip it down to do something small. So definitely good to have, you know, good to have small... Small cabling, card reader options. Just have it all in one. So look, you know, I definitely, obviously, because this is expandable all the way from tiny, you know, almost photojourno size camera right up to full studio camera. Obviously, it makes sense to have this amount of modules. But yeah, it'd definitely be good to find out what all these things are going to cost and when are we actually going to get our hands on them.
Hey, something else that was released in the news this week that I think is terrific is some freeware called ClipFinder. Now, we really like ClipFinder. We really like ClipFinder version 1. We're also really enthusiastic about ClipFinder version 2.2, which is going to be coming out. But the one that it has at the moment, ClipFinder, is we'll put a link in the show notes to where you can find it. But it basically allows you to kind of play and annotate. Thank you. Clips. And you can, you know, basically play stuff, have a look at it. Not only that, though, that there are some other things you can do which are kind of really cool. You can quickly open stuff in Red Alert. You can also take stuff from there into Final Cut, allowing you to kind of do stuff quickly. And you can render clips out in QuickTime, DPX, or TIFF. So there's a bunch of stuff that it's doing. Coming up, you're going to be able to perform basic color corrections. You're going to be able to set multiple in and out points and do stuff with the RSX settings. So it's a bit... sitting in the world of, I guess, what you'd call Red Rushes, and I'll be covering Red Rushes later.
But like Aperture, I suppose. Aperture for RSVG. Well, to be able to just
I hadn't thought of that way.
Collate, select, maybe. You know, open them up, inspect them.
It's also going to have a bunch of new render options in the new version coming out. But even at the moment, I think it's definitely worth downloading and having a play with.
Yeah.
And it's as I say, it's free. Sort of, I think this whole the reason I don't think of it like Aperture, I think of Aperture as a sort of end point. I guess some people would see it as a way station on the way to Photoshop, but this definitely is not sort of really coming out as an end point so much as it is a clip manipulator. But if you were I guess the analogy I would probably more likely to use is be bridge than aperture.
Yeah.
If you're in CS world. But anyway, it's definitely really good, and I recommend that you check it out if you've got some free time.
And important to note, it is actually, I mean, it is freeware, but it is actually donateware. There is a donate button on the site when you go to download it. If you think it's cool, you know, let's support the guy. And it's pretty rare, at least at this end of town, that you actually get something that's something for nothing, so to speak. So let's, you know, maybe if you think it's making your life a little easier.
I mean, Red's traditionally had some really good freeware things, as we'll discuss later, like Crimson. That's first
true.
That's true. But then people did get behind Crimson and support it. So, yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Now, you found something else to do with light meters. What was that?
Yeah, well, look, there's been a little bit of static about the whole Red one, what its ISO rating is, what its IE rating is. So I thought we'd get stuck into that now. No. So obviously what Ryan Walters, a DP, has done a little bit of quite a good blog posting about calibrating your light meter, not necessarily calibrating it to the Red or your particular Red so much, because I don't really believe in that. I think your light meter should be your light meter. It should be calibrated correctly and not necessarily go way off adjusting it to a camera that could be, you know, way off. But it's just important to, you know, if you're using a light meter, keep it well adjusted. And he's got some great sort of workflow about aligning your light meter to some specific charts and, you know, setting it correct. And also, basically, there's some good backstory and some good info about that whole adjustment process and about, you know, just light meters in general. So I've got links to that in the show notes, so that's definitely worth a look.
He is actually a Red supporter. It's like he is, you said not particularly the Red, but he shoots with the Red.
Yeah, yes, no, absolutely, but I didn't, it's this setup tips is not necessarily totally relating to Red. It can, you know, it's setting up a light meter. It's not necessarily totally calibrating it to a Red One camera. It's just calibrating it in general.
So another thing that that you have on our running sheet is Master and Slave, which is actually a Red user thing. What's that?
I think it's a bit of a little underground sort of tip that looks like it's always been there in the latest firmware for the Red One, is that you can actually, by a simple act of hooking a USB cable from one Red One to another, you can totally sync one camera to the other if you're doing 3D work. I don't know what the other applications of this are, but essentially, obviously, you roll one, the other one rolls. It totally syncs the GPI triggers and playing, fast-forward, all the sort of transport functions. I guess it starts all naming of clip conventions, and that all sort of links together. All the shutter speeds, all of the settings on one Red One will sync through to the other.
Good if you had a studio set up and you wanted to shoot. Just, you know.
Yeah. Or do you? I wonder, as soon as you unplug, do those settings go then? I wonder if you can actually. It's almost like, you know, how you'd go around doing time code where you'd sort of set, you know, you'd sort of jam sync the time code on all each and then you disconnect it and they're all running. I'm not quite sure whether this is a set and then you can disconnect or what the applications outside of the 3D applications are. But again, links to the show notes to some further info on that one. But it's quite cool to see that sort of hidden function.
Oh, yeah. So I speaking of Twitter things, because that's where that storm in a Twitter cup came from with your ISO thing.
Mm.
One thing that did pop up on Twitter during the week, which I thought was incredibly cool, was the Megan Fox shoot for Esquire magazine.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys heard about this, but Greg Williams decided to do a photo shoot for the cover of Esquire magazine and didn't use a digital SLR, actually used a Red One. And what's really phenomenally interesting about that is that, you know, they ended up with basically moving covers. So you get kind of the moving cover freezing on the frame of the cover. And I thought what was sort of interesting is the logic behind why he decided to go that way. And it wasn't just a geeking out thing. It was to do with her acting, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously she is, I suppose she's just as much of an actor as a model, although acting ability is debatable. But, it's essentially to, I guess that the mindset was that rather than her being conscious that, you have to pose and then find another pose. And then as soon as you see the flash or you see the camera or hear the camera fire, you know, the store's camera fire, you feel, okay, well, what am I going to do next? I've got to find another pose.
Because Megan Fox is too young to have seen Madonna's Vogue video. Is that what you're saying?
Strike a pose.
Too young for Duran Duran girls on film. Yeah, and so having her actually act out scenes and then just being able to film them and lift out 4K frames from it was a pretty interesting concept. And I guess for me, I don't, you know, I had thought about obviously doing this because we've often discussed the fact that you can lift out a 4K frame from the Red, but still the Red One form factor. I mean, this is something that I expect to happen once we go to Epics.
Yeah.
But it's interesting people are doing already with Red Ones. But yeah, I think you'll see a lot more of this hybrid shooting once we go to the Epic.
But yeah, because obviously they've obviously ended up with a whole lot of footage that they're going to cut together. I'm not quite sure what form it's going to take, but it actually should be online by the time you hear this. Esquire.com/Megan. Theoretically, there'll be
mini movies.
They should be editing some mini movies. I'm not sure of the artistic worth of it. But look, it's certainly an interesting idea.
I'm quite sure of the sexist nature of it. But anyway, go on.
But look, it's quite a good experiment, and it's good to see is that it's been brought to the forefront, obviously. There's a lot of guys who've been shooting stills with the Red One for a while, and Greg has had a Red for a while. But it's good to see it sort of thrown into the forefront here, putting, you know, on the front cover of Esquire and with some accompanying press to it. They're sort of making something of it for themselves that, you know, this cover was shot with a video camera, and if you want to see more of the front cover, go to this website. So it's really quite interesting. And what's cool is when you go, if you go to the Esquire's website and you see this shot, you're looking at a still frame, but that sort of in the background, once the flash movie loads, it suddenly comes to life and you sort of see this Esquire cover suddenly sort of start animating. So it is kind of interesting. Greg has been started off as a photojournalist, and then he has done an awful lot of on-set stills, on-set of movies. In fact, he's published three or four books on set with Bond and Greg Williams on set. So he's actually got a few fantastic sort of books of on set. So it's kind of obviously has grown up in that movie world, really. So it's kind of cool to see someone with this mindset sort of bringing the two disciplines together. So, yeah, pretty cool. Esquire.com/Megan.
Definitely. Hey, so surprise, surprise. During the week, Jim jumped in on a discussion over noisy tungsten footage. Like, tell me something I don't know.
Well, it's interesting to see it acknowledged, I guess.
Well, we've been saying for ages that the sweet spot is 5600 or 5000. 5000 being kind of more of an electronic white light flash. And I think it's more of a northern hemisphere kind of light. 5600 is what I kind of read down here, even possibly higher. But definitely 5000, 5600, not much difference between them compared to tungsten. And so Jim said, yeah, basically better off shooting daylight than tungsten. Whatever you do, if you're shooting tungsten, don't underexpose. And if you can, add in gels and filters such as 80B or ADC.
Right. So theoretically, if you are going to set up a studio shoot with a Red One and you're not relying on any other light coming through windows or any sort of daylight coming through or any other sort of color temps coming through, if you've got totally the choice of which lights to pull out of the truck, the theory being, you know, head for
daylight,
really. I'm wondering if that's just part of that whole sort of thing of people figuring that the Red One is not as sensitive as its rating, whether people are pulling out a light meter and getting a great reading under tungsten.
I've seen tons of people use and abuse Reds over their ability to do green screen keying.
I've had the same.
Well, actually, it was blue screen shot under tungsten, and it was kind of a bit underexposed. And I'll go, well, three hits and you're out. Like, that's going to be really hard to key. Underexposed blue screen on tungsten is like a nightmare. And then the same person will sit down a week later and get green screen shot daylight nicely exposed, 50 IRE. Oh, my God, this keys brilliantly. What do they do to the camera? But, yeah, so I don't think there's any surprises in that. Is this the first time we've had them be so explicit about it? But I mean,
I think it probably is.
We've been saying this now for a while.
I mean, they're obviously mentioning start rating everything at 250 if you're doing green screen work. or if you're working under tungsten, go to 250. So really that sort of acknowledgement that the whole IE is maybe, the whole IE doesn't match 320, the camera is not rated for 320, really is more probably, maybe in daylight it probably is, but once you head into tungsten world, that's where the exposure difference is.
I'm not there. Look, I just rated the bloody thing at 320, and then the huge discussion was at 250. I said, well, we get rate at 320, leave the bloody camera set at 320, tell the DOP if they don't know the red to think of it like 250 daylight, and thanks for playing.
Yeah.
And getting into a huge bitch fight over whether it's 250 or 320, I mean, really, I just don't think it makes that much difference. It's not the be-all and end-all of what's going to make a good-looking shot.
Well, if you're the cameraman and you put your 320 on your meter and you're getting really only getting 250, say, then you're already a little bit heading towards underexposing, which, you know, in the green screen town, you're going to, you know, that you're
that little bit... I sort of agree with you, except for there are so many other meters. Like, you could get an IRE meeting, metered reading through the lens. God, I can't speak today. And, you know, you can do a whole lot of other things. And quite frankly, if you were shooting daylight and so, you know, you're shooting green screen, for example, and not blue, then whether you were 250 or 320 wouldn't make any difference.
Yeah.
I would willing to put my hand on my heart and say you could do no keen difference between those two.
Well, look, I think part of the gotchas with all of this is when you've got film guys who are A, used to playing with meters and setting the stop on the lens to the meter, and also used to, if you're lighting someone standing on a green screen, they used to say, okay, we've got a green screen, right, so let's put, you know, two blondies on that side and two blondies on that side, that's lit the green screen in the foreground. Well, if you're lighting something and someone standing in the studio, the kind of classic mindset is to just pull tungsten stuff out. I don't know why. You don't normally, unless you're needing big, lots of firepower, the psychology is just because they're cheaper and easier and you're not sort of trying to balance light to anything is to start pulling tungsten stuff out.
We shot daylight with 80Bs on dwarf, and then we also shot tungsten. Like, we shot some tungsten stuff. We were shooting anamorphics and we shot tungsten. It's not like you can't do it. It's just that you want to not underexpose it, and we weren't shooting the king stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it looks nice.
So I guess, I obviously don't necessarily trust the meter. You've got all this fabulous...
this really good-looking picture. Like, we walk over and it looks really dark.
Yeah.
Oh, we did that one time. It was like, this looks really wrong. It's like, well, the meter... Oh, I don't care what the meter says. Like, this bloody camera looks really dark to me. Can we punch more light in, please?
Yeah, well, look, so it's interesting to see it all acknowledged, and also to see someone break it down in just a few quick key points. Again, we'll put this link to the show notes.
And speaking of show notes, we've got something unusual, because we can't really describe this, but you've got an incredibly cool chart that you lifted from, I think, Red User.
Totally pinched from, who did this? Stephen Hilder, is it?
And
Stephen Hilder, who has posted this chart on Red User. Obviously, because what's happening at the moment is a little bit of confusion about the whole 4K sensors and the 5K sensors, and the fact that the 5K sensors in the Mysterium X will be a slightly larger sensor, which is great. So theoretically, you're going to get a field of view of a 50mm lens on a Red 1 will look like a bit of a 40mm lens on a Mysterium X sensor, on a 5K sensor, purely because it's just, obviously, it's a larger sensor, so it's going to look like the same from going pretty much from putting a lens on a, I'll say a Nikon D200 versus a D3. You go from APS-C's type sensor up to more
full frame. Oh, that's 35. A bigger jump.
It's a slightly bigger job. I'm drawing an analogy.
As an analogy, Mike. Okay.
Okay.
All right,
not a fully
analogy.
Technical, exactly measured comment, no.
Okay, because that's like quite a significant jump on those cases.
Yeah, I was just sort of drawing the analogy of difference.
I'm sorry, I'll shut up now.
Yeah.
Anyway, your chart has other stuff, right? Like the 2/3 inch Mysterium X and
It's interesting
S35
to see. And also showing you what actual field of view, how much of the sensor you're using, depending on if you're used to shooting 16:9, 2:1, or if you're using the full sensor. So, like, say the little... I mean, obviously, I guess until things are obviously launched, we're talking pie in the sky specs
what
here
has been published?
For 2/3 DSMC for the, say the 2/3 inch Scarlett, right? The full sensor is a whopping 10 millimeters by 5 millimeters, and once you start
which
shooting,
is like about a, but it's like a 5 megapixel camera, right?
Oh,
Whereas the what I'm after is the S35, right, which is basically a 15 megapixel stills camera.
Sure, 11, the red one.
No, the S35.
Oh, okay, right.
5K.
Yeah. Right. Yes. It didn't say megapixels here. But I'm just fascinated. Once you start to dig down into here, and you've got the 2/3 inch Scarlett, and when you start shooting 16:9 on 2/3 Scarlett, even then you're starting to eat in on that sensor and slowly eroding your field of view, and thus eroding your depth of field.
Okay, so you're not though, Jace. You're not.
Well, in a way, if you've got one,
you're not changing the depth of field unless bloody camera.
Yeah, I know. Okay, right.
I mean,
It's wrong. Okay.
Well, no, but
wrong
people listen to this and they worship you as a god. And when you say that it changes the depth of field, then on Twitter I have like a fight with people over going. But
it
you said on Red
Center,
change
the depth of field. Yeah. Okay, your depth of field does not change, but then you're only going to need to sort
field
of swing.
Field of view changes.
Field of view changes, which means to get the same size shot, you need to swap your lens over. As soon as you swap
your lens over, then all bets are off.
Then your depth of field has changed. Okay, so yeah. So for me, it's all about being able to get as much a bigger, fatter size of sensor as possible. So being able to shoot with
the 5K. And Mr. Jim actually commented on why they chose 5K for the Epic X and the Mysterium, right?
Why is that?
I mean, for the he posted on Red User, like
yes.
the why Red uses 5K.
Yeah, and it's all to do with the what the actual. Now, maybe you can explain this comment here, okay? 5K red Bayer capture is roughly the equivalent of a 4K measured output resolution.
Yep.
Okay.
What, do you want me to explain that?
Yeah.
Okay,
please.
Well,
so then we'll
it's
both
really simple,
know.
Right? Like, when you shoot HD with an HD sensor, you don't actually get HD resolution. When you shoot on the 4K red one, you get about 3.2K. Now, personally, I think this is, like, again, just out of control ridiculous, right? Because quite frankly, it looks like we tested it, and I, guilty of this myself. Like when we first put a first test chart on the Red One back in September of whenever that was, and it just came out, and we obviously couldn't measure 4K resolution because you can't, because you're running at a theoretical point,
yeah.
And also quite frankly, there is some processing that goes on the image to not make it quite as sharp, to make it not have moiré patterns and other artifacts you don't like. So the 4K sensor is a 4K sensor. It just produces 3.2K worth of delineable resolution when you start putting up test charts and stuff, which is fine, right? Because like a 2K projector...
You're talking about MTF at the end once you've actually put a piece of glass on it that...
If you put a piece of film in a projector and project it at the cinema, you've got about 900 lines resolution. And nobody in the cinema goes, I want my money back, because I watched Wolverine last night and you said it was on film, and it was on film, but I was only getting 900 MTF kind of resolution out of the projector, and I was expecting it to be 2K. Mm. I mean, you just go, oh, wow, Wolverine. How did he cut the helicopter blades without his fingers breaking off? You're not sitting there going, I find the relative resolution due to the weave and float and subsequent printing loss through the interpose and interneg to be unsatisfactory, because you go to a film and you're not a geek. And so arguing about...
These are the kind of people that email you, Mike.
Oh, they bloody do. And I love them for it. But, it's like the 4K... is not 4K, it's 3.2. So I'm like, okay, all right, you want a friggin' 4K camera? We'll make a 5K camera that'll then be your 4K camera. Will that keep you happy?
Yes.
Then you are actually producing 4K delineable resolution, and you can say we've got 4K. Because everyone was arguing with Red, like no tomorrow, over the fact whether it's really 4K or not. It was a big con, which quite frankly, as I say, I think is a whole... It's just a truckload of hurt, and what do I care? Do you know what I mean? Like, it's still... the best resolution we've seen on a camera of, electronic digital camera like this. So.
Yeah. And well, there's also, Jim also goes on to say that the highest measured resolution of a 4K film scan from Super 35 is around 3.1, 3.2. So that theoretically comes from one of the major studio tech guys basically saying, obviously, even if you've got an absolutely fantastic 4K, as you're saying, 4K film scan, you really the resolution that you're actually getting up on screen is 3.1, 3.2.
But there's just nothing wrong with that, right? I mean, there's just nothing wrong with the concept that... But, you know, you have to sort of do something, right? And so, like, you know, you pick numbers that mean something. As long as you're all playing on the same playing field, if you go, what is the sensor size? It's 4K. And then everyone knows it's 4K, but obviously it won't resolve fully to 4K, but it'll resolve to something close to it, unless there's a problem, which, you know, obviously in this case there isn't. But here's the other thing, right? Like, weave and float, scratches, noise, film grain, like all the other stuff. I mean, you know, it's like you're arguing over the 10-20% here and ignoring the... elephant in the room.
None of it matters with some of the freaking screenings I've been to in the last month, let me tell you.
You mean red screenings or film screenings?
Film screenings.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, The Boat That Rocked looked like that I saw last week. I only saw it. It's like the first week it had been screening here in Australia. It looked like the whole thing had been shot with a shift lens.
You know, when I was watching that film, you know, the American played by
Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah. I had you in my head, man.
What?
Yeah. You're hip, you're an authority figure, you're, you know...
Much older, bearded, heavily set American person.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. Lady killer, you know, drink hard.
Okay.
Yeah. Also, Red Rocket, that it will actually be out in 2 months, which is good, right? We're going to move along because we're out of time.
Yep, sure.
Which is great because we had 2 months, no, maybe next year, and now they've come out and said, no, they will try for 2 months.
Yep.
So I guess 2 months is the month of May and June, so end of what we'd call our financial year, end of June 30th. We should be hanging out for some hardcore acceleration. And while we're at it, we should quickly go on to the last part of the news, which is... No, I've lost it. The last part of the news. Yeah. Which is... Oh, no, it's gear. Okay, we'll do gear after our interview because I wanted to talk about that new cool, eSATA cable we mentioned, but we'll do that after our thing. So we've got three more segments coming up. We've got the gear coming up.
Yep.
We've got that terrific interview coming up with our Academy Award winning, perhaps slightly not red this time, but we don't care, cinematographer.
Absolutely. Get a chance to nab him. We'll nab him regardless.
And before that, we're going to change gears now and do part three of our workflow geek out on the workflow for doing post-production. And this is, if you haven't listened recently, we started this for the month of April, and our plan was to do 4 eps. We got 2 done, then we stopped last week because we had the NAB feedback.
Excellent feedback.
We thought, why waste time? We'll come back
to
this.
We had so much to talk about with Jeff.
So this week I get to talk to you a little bit about Avid and Final Cut workflow. Though, as I said last time we did this, this is all covered in excruciatingly cool depth in our FX PhD courses where we sort of go through this in detail. So some people have started sending us emails in, and I'm going to answer a couple of those in the process of doing this other work with you right now. But yeah, you know, a detailed discussion. People would say, like, can't you just go? Like, yeah, over on FX PhD. That's exactly what we do. So you can check that at fxphd.com.
This is the in-depth overview versus the absolute serious nuts and bolts.
This is the what?
This is an overview, in-depth, quite in-depth overview.
In-depth overview.
Yeah.
The in-depth overview. Okay. So if you remember last time we discussed workflow, and we discussed in particular the idea of red space, and there was just one question coming out of that, which I thought was a real cracker from Pete. And Pete Wellington said that he wondered on the camera when I switched the button over to look at the difference of, say, the output on the monitor, like the side monitor being, say, Rec 709, was I flicking both the color space and the gamma? And the answer is, well, yeah, because what's happening there is that you need a gamma to display it. You're not going to display... the idea is that you would display a raw feed out there if you wanted to add on some kind of Luther box or something to add a third-party LUT pipe. But if you're wanting to look at it on set to just see what you're getting, then you're going to look at it in basically the color space that you pick, which would normally be Rec 709 if you're doing broadcast work. If you weren't, you might look at it in red space. And certainly red space... is great for doing that. And yes, you are effectively having a look at the stuff that's coming off the sensor running through 2 levels of processing, being the color space and gamma correction, so that what looks on your screen looks normal, which, you know, might be up on the LCD monitor beside the DOP or, in fact...
And obviously neither of that affecting the actual R3D. It's all just EXIF data, yeah?
Absolutely. It's just a like a preview.
Yeah.
And that's cool.
Yeah. But it does, obviously, at the other end, it's affecting jumping ahead and rabbiting on, even though we don't have the time. That XF and what you set it to follow through into red space and or obviously red space or red alert rather will remember what your LUT and
everything's metadata. Okay, so let's just talk about the workflow. So we've now assumed that we've covered the red apps and that there's one that I kept up my sleeve, which was Red Rushes, which is super significant and incredibly important, but it falls more in the line of an Avid Final Cut workflow. So I was going to discuss this week, offlining Avid Final Cut. So two important things to just really hit here is that this is only focused on Avid and Final Cut workflow for offline, online purposes. Obviously, you can take Avid and say, oh, I'm going to finish it on DS. Well, yes, that's an Avid product, and yes, you are finishing it on DS, and DS will natively read the R3Ds. Not discussing that this week.
Yeah.
You can take Final Cut, and you can finish on Final Cut, and that's going to be also discussed next week. What I want to discuss this week is your traditional idea of an offline and online. And here we have some fairly simple concepts, but it gets a little confusing because there's a lot of very, very cool, very helpful third-party tools to bridge some gaps. And they, I think, are what caused the problems. So it just breaks down really simply like this. I shot my R3Ds. I can take that into Final Cut on a Mac, obviously, and I can open up the QuickTime proxy and just start editing with it. I also have ways of accessing the R3D because the R3D can be read by Final Cut, and I can do that in color or in Final Cut. And that whole idea of editing the R3Ds and the QuickTime proxies are linked at this point because in the simple case, they're coming out of the same folder and they've got the same file name and it's pretty, pretty simple. Now, if I wanted to do a huge amount of Final Cut editing and I could not have online in the offline edit suite, if that makes sense, if I couldn't have available in the offline edit suite a vast amount of storage to store all that, like on a feature or whatever, I'm going to have to transcode it to something else. If I'm in Avid, I can't open up the Final Cut, R3D files and successfully read them, nor can I open up the QuickTimes and just bring them into Avid and start editing with them because Avid doesn't cut Final Cut style, doesn't cut QuickTimes natively. So you have to transcode it. So there's the problem. You've got to get your stuff from R3D World to some other file format, and that alone ain't the problem. The problem is it's an offline. So I'm going to throw that footage away. I want to go back to the original R3Ds and retransfer those. And this is just completely like what we're used to with film, 35mm neg, transfer it to a tape, which might be a digibeta. They would digitize that or at an Avid digitizing station. But when you're cutting, what do you do with that Avid footage, right? Throw it away.
Yeah.
You go back with a EDL, which then gets C list sorted into the order at which you shot stuff. The neg cutters cut down your neg. You then transfer that film to now SR tape. And that is a grading process, and you take your SR tape and grade it. Now, that has seems to morphed into, I'll get all this stuff transferred, and then I will have it on SR tape, but really good bit depth and stuff, and then I'll grade it and then compile it. But yeah, let's just forget about that for a second and just assume that it's still an offline online process. So far, so good?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so first thing we wanted to do was we wanted to get it into Avid, and we didn't have any way of getting the Avid to understand any of the metadata because for that whole process to work, I have to have a loopback. By loopback, I mean I have to get back from offline to access the original file. So let's say I shot tons and tons of footage. I have a file. I need the Avid to be able to say to some other friggin' computer, hey, this is the name of the file that we used to do something. So I'm going to use an analogy here. Sorry, a little story, an anecdote. Jason and I have shot a guy pressing a button that causes the helicopter to explode. Okay? So this is just like we filmed this sequence. He runs in, smashes open the doors to the secret lab, leaps across the room in slow motion, slams his button down in the middle of the room, and outside a helicopter that was about to blow up something blows up. Okay, done. Now, I take that into Avid and to edit it, and I got 10 takes of the guy running down the hallway. I maybe got one or two takes of a helicopter model exploding. I'm going to have to get that out to VFX guys. But I've got 10 takes of this guy running down the hallway. And I probably got it on multiple cameras. And so, Jace, you're editing, and you're going to need, you know, just a bunch of time to edit that, right?
Yeah.
But more importantly, you don't care about image quality too much, right? What do you like to edit? You're just good enough to see, presumably.
Yeah, right? I've no idea what ratio of the compression my editor will cut in, but
yeah. It just sort of looks kind of normal.
Yeah. I think it's, you know, 10 to 1, 20 to 1. I don't know, something.
But
ridiculous.
Just sort of looks.
Yeah, it just looks
screen,
fine. Right? Absolutely, yep. No one's gonna. Yeah, just so it doesn't look crappy. So don't start seeing horrible sort of blocky compression shit.
Yeah, in the way that a JPEG looks normal, but yeah. It's not as good as the RAW file on a stills camera. Okay.
It's kind of important that it looks not that great, just so people don't start going, hey.
That's another interesting point, actually. Yeah, don't fall in love with it. Okay, yeah. But if you were to stop there in the Avid and then say, well, it looks okay to me, I'm going to output this and I'm going to hand that helicopter footage off to the effects guys. The effects guys would all like reel back in horror and go, but this is highly compressed footage with no latitude, and how am I going to key off this? And there are artifacts. And you're like, well, it looks all right to me. It's like, well, yeah, but you know, this is like a preview, right? It's like trying to do massive color correction on a JPEG. It's going to break up at some point. So you go, oh, all right, well, I can't do that. I'm going to go back to the original files. And at that second you go back to the original files, in the old days, the EDL would just refer to the key code, in other words, the edge code on the piece of film. No problem, because the Telecine read the key code was translated into time code, the time code was loaded by Avid, you cut to the time code, and when you output an EDL, an edit decision list of decisions based on that time code, use the time code to access back to the film again.
Yeah.
No problemo. Problem with this red scenario is you get into bloody Avid and voila, it can't actually remember the time codes because it can't read the time codes of the original files, and even if it could, it doesn't understand the file names, and it all became a big nightmare. And so we broke the ability to get out of the Avid and back to the original source files. It just wasn't easy. So then a guy who is a DOP and an ex-kind of researching guy invented Crimson, and Crimson today is like about $189, and it's free for the first 5 clips if you want to test that workflow. And it was a bridge to help me get across to get back, if you like, to relink to the original source files. Now, we don't tend to use Crimson that much anymore. I don't anyway. But there's a bunch of programs that have now come up and ways to bridge that problem. So let's just go through them, and I'll just give you the rundown. But all of these assume either Avid or a Final Cut workflow where you're not editing with the native R3D files, because you can't do that, because you can't have 10 terabytes to the offline editor. He just doesn't want that. And why 10 terabytes? Well, you can't separate your R3D files from your QuickTime proxy, so you have to give them all of the raw data to be able to work with. Even though it's still an R3D format, it's too much. Okay, and I know, as I said at the outset, there are tons of programs that can now read R3Ds directly. That's next week. Okay, so let's start out with Automatic Duck. So Automatic Duck is a program. It's about $500, and it was designed to help people get between boxes, basically. It wasn't a RED-specific product. An Automatic Duck, Jace, will go and take my Final Cut stuff and export from Final Cut something that I can take into Quantel or Avid, for that matter. But it does Pro Tools, it does a bunch of things, and it's basically exporting AAF or OMF, sequence meter if you want, and it's bridging the gap to get from the Final Cut stuff to something that Avid can understand in a pretty simple, easy way.
So why would you go that way via Final Cut to go to Avid? Because that's where you've sunk up your rushes, or that's how
you... Could be where you've sunk up rushes, exactly. And it's just, if you want to go that way, Automatic Duck is a great way to go. Now, you may not want to go that way. You may not want to go anywhere near Final Cut, in which case you might want to use Avid's solution. Now, Avid's come up with something called MetaFuse, and in fact, it works very similar to the Autodesk Flame solution, which we'll cover next week, which works off Wiretap Central. And both of these guys came up, being Avid and Autodesk, came up with an idea of, hey, what if I had a program that handled this problem for you, that was like a R3D interface thing? So this is the new way of working. And so you would just use MetaFuse to make the Avid DNX HD, and there would be basically EDL or XML support from that out, so that you could use something to effectively pull your rushes, and that would be like Red Cine, or it could be another thing I'm about to talk about called Monkey Extract, and that's going to basically then hit your R3Ds and pull them out as, say, DPXs. So right. Avid's MetaFuse the word meta, I used to hate this word meta. I mean, I just was longing for someone to invent a better word. It just seemed like the dorkiest word ever. But the metadata simply means all the stuff that isn't the image data that will allow me to solve these problems. And so the problem isn't the pictures, because we've established that, you know, pictures are okay. It's just that I can't, like, find the file, literally. And so the metadata would be like the file name. Metadata is also the time code. So if I'm editing in Avid with MetaFuse, now it's managing those file names and time code so that later when it outputs something, I can, say XML, I could load that XML in Redcine. It would access the R3D files and then bring them all up in the timeline, and then I'd hit export a bunch of DPXs and I'd have finished the game.
So do you have to go through a Red Alert or Redcine to get this, or you can literally just have MetaFuse and Avid
and R3D. I'm getting in.
Yep.
But I've got to get it. All I'm doing is handling the metadata.
Yep,
I've got the images, by the way.
Yes.
But I don't have is it won't conform the R3Ds. So I still need something else to grab those R3Ds and conform. Now, that could be Scratch, could be a bunch of things. Could be Redcine, because Redcine does XML conform, or it could be Monkey Extract. Now, Monkey Extract by Rubber Monkey Software basically does the extracting process of saying, okay, give me some kind of EDL or XML-y thing, and I will render the red files into something that the VFX community or the grading community can deal with without knowing anything about red. So that's like $349 for a normal version, about $850, these are all US numbers, for a render farm version. Now, the Monkey Extract, what it's saying is it can do a bunch of like utility things that are kind of useful. But if you think about the words Monkey Extract, it's like, I don't care, just get a bunch of monkeys to go off and extract all my files. I don't want to know about it. But they can also rename your red footage. They can copy the red files over. So let's say you had an EDL or a timeline. You might say, hey, I need all of the red files that are in this timeline moved over to this other machine. It would go do that.
Right.
It would update DPX headers. So let's say I output a bunch of DPX files for film, and I wanted to go in and update all the right names and stuff in the, and all that data. That's because if you remember, a Cineon file is the core picture file of film. It's like 10-bit log. Doesn't have much metadata. You stick metadata with a Cineon file and you get a DPX file. It's like DPX files like a container that holds both your picture and this Telecine type information like timecode. So that's what it does. It updates that. And of course, because it's Monkey Extract, it also enough Monkey Extracts will go and write you a complete works of Shakespeare. Okay. So then the other thing that we have is a thing called MetaCheater. Now MetaCheater is a tool like Avid MetaFuse. Though it has the distinct advantage of being cheaper. And it's basically, it's allowing you to get information from the R3D files and transfer it on. So you would get basically metadata from the QuickTime of the R3Ds and put it in an ALE, which is an Avid log exchange format. And then that metadata is imported into Avid. And so Avid now understands stuff like timecode and stuff that it was missing. Because, you know, there are two timecodes in a red file, you know, edge timecode and universal or global timecode, or I like to call it time of timecode. And so you need to sort of cheat that metadata into Avid. So the name is very good, MetaCheater.
But all of these are not actually doing any file conversion in terms of the actual video.
Some of them are converting files.
Okay. Actually, because obviously what you're going to do
like is... Like MetaFuse is doing that.
Okay. So MetaFuse, basically, you could just look at a drive full of R3Ds, and it'll help you ingest it into DNX HD or whatever you call it, right?
Avid DNX HD, yep.
Thank you. Okay. And obviously, so once they're converted in, it's going to carry through the correct code...
To get back out
from,
again.
To get back to, pull to, your, to then reconform later.
Yeah. So Avid has a bunch of these DNX HD formats, which are different amounts of effectively compression. So 3640, 115, 120, 175, 180, and uncompressed. And so what we're talking about is you're using the uncompressed versions of Avid's DNX HD, because obviously if they're uncompressed, well, you've bloody solved the problem, haven't you? You've just converted them to uncompressed files and you're editing uncompressed, and you can edit uncompressed with any bloody thing. Yeah. It's like transferring your film uncompressed and then just editing it. You don't have to go back and retransfer it.
Sure, but obviously half the point of working with compressed files
is faster, easier,
it's quicker. Much faster to, you know, do changes, shift dissolves around, simple little effects and matting, so you can, you know, pretty much edit as fast as the director can change his mind.
Yeah. Now, the other bit of the equation. So these are all, you know, that's a good sort of set of things. The other one is Red Rushes. Now, I held off discussing Red Rushes. Now, Red Rushes is part of the free set of stuff that you get from the Happy Red Company. And the Happy Red Company's Red Rushes, there's a product called Red Line, which is basically line-based or code-based scripting stuff to transfer and convert files. That came out, and that was like a breath of fresh air because Red Cine, quite frankly, bit cumbersome. It's got a user interface, kind of good for looking at things, not really good for hardcore stuff. So the way to think of Red Rushes is a graphical user interface on the scripting stuff. Right. So when you think of scripting, you tend to think very powerful, not very easy to use.
Yeah.
But, wow, I can just crunch through stuff. Well, that's what Red Rushes is. So if I was wanting to transfer stuff, for example, out of, you know, where I am to something like DPXs or TIFFs, then I could easily use Red Rushes to go in, and what it would say is, I'm going to load up a whole lot of clips. It will actually look at, if you've taken them into Red Alert, at the in and out points if you ask it to that you might have set up there.
Yep.
It'll also look at the look you might have established.
Yep.
And this is really cool, is that if you've established a look in one clip, you can just say, you know what, that one look for all the footage we shot on day one, I want it on every clip.
So you can set up a look for take one and then
everything
say
just
ingest.
Instantly applied. And so in a sense, Red Rushes is the one maybe I should have started with, but it's, I think of it as the exception because while it's rushes, it's not rushes designed necessarily to go back to the R3Ds. It could just be that this is how you want to transfer your footage to get it out to be DPXs or to be TIFFs, and then game over. I'm just going to work like normal after that. But you could also output as a QuickTime, and if you did output it as a QuickTime, you can burn in time code. You can, you know, do tons of stuff to keep it going. You can scale it. You can crop it. You can do all that kind of stuff. You can pick what time code you use. And as I say, you can make it with different debugger qualities and stuff. So Red Rushes sort of is the backbone for anyone that wants to, knows what they're doing, wants to go in there and just transfer a bunch of files. Like, it's fast, it's hardcore. So in our workflow that you heard last week with Dean, we used Red Rushes to convert all the files for being able to just, like, without editing. You know, like at the start, we just converted them for offline.
Right.
So, as I said, in one sense, you could say it's the non-offline process. I just edit stuff out. But in the other, yeah, we used it in offline because we just said, you know what, bring everything in, transfer it to the hard drive, make sure it's all there.
Yep.
Then just produce a bunch of QuickTimes for editing and send them into, we used a Mac-based Avid system. And then we used Automatic Duck to manage, so we loaded those up into Final Cut. We used Automatic Duck to then turn that into an Avid file that was readable, and all the media was the same. It relinks through, and we're into Avid, and Avid now understands what's going on. And the Final Cut wasn't an editing station. It was just a way station on the way through to Avid that let us convert everything and that into a format that Avid understood. And Automatic Duck, if you want to think of it this way, is the, you know, thing that Final Cut doesn't have inside it to seamlessly move it over to being an Avid project from being a Final Cut project.
So you were using Red Rushes to batch convert
everything
to QuickTimes.
But with the look, exactly.
Yes.
With the look.
Apply
that we
the
wanted,
look, batch apply the look.
Because that's where it became significant. Like, so let's say you were the DOP, you'd walk over. We've been shooting this morning in the cold bluey set, and you go, you know, I want it to look bluey. Don't color correct that out.
Yeah.
But maybe even a bit bluer. That's not coming through as much as I wanted to my eye. Just, I really want that, so just pump it a little bit more and crush the blacks a little. Yep, I'm happy with that. Great, just run all the rushes like that. And it just towered, a tower Mac just plowed through rushes, transferring them out. And then Automatic Duck helped us get into Avid. And now Avid understands the time codes. It understands the look, because obviously we wanted to set that look up. And Red Rushes have done that for us. But also it's a bulk renderer. It just renders like crazy and it's free. So
Red Rushes.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you were rendering out to QuickTime.
QuickTime, absolutely.
But then you had to to get that into the Avid has to convert it over from QuickTime to
the NXHD.
Well,
no, in this particular case, we were
sorry,
working
you were
in a Mac Avid.
Final Cut. Okay.
No, Mac Avid.
Right.
And And so we ingested stuff into the Avid, and that was a...
So Mac Avids will read QuickTime and ingest QuickTime.
Absolutely. Okay. And okay. Also, so I'm so used you can also output stuff and transcode it if you want and stuff. But yes, I might have done, I don't know, DVX Pro 720 or some other darn thing.
Right.
And I could just output to Avid DNX from Red Rushes.
There is a difference in the in what files can be ingested, whether you're working on a Mac Avid or a PC Avid.
Yeah, but that's like, that's not the point of what we were doing. We actually output it to DNX Avid format.
Right, okay.
It just, I misled you then slightly. So yes, we, in Red Rushes on the Mac,
yes,
can make Avid DNX HD files in 720p or 100 and...
Okay, I've never played with it, HD, obviously,
yeah.
Because...
Yeah, sure. Hey. So why the point is, yeah, yes, you can make stuff in that Mac Avid, okay. That's a side awesome. Thing.
Right, gotcha.
So the point here is that to get the Avid working, Red Rushes is producing Avid DNX HD files, and it's really simple because there were Avid-based Macs, everything just flowed super, super fast.
Right.
And so my point in saying all that is that Red Rushes is not only we use it for that, but in fact, if we're doing something much, much, much smaller, like FX Guide TV app, and we just know what clips we want, we may actually go into, say, Red Alert and just set some in and out points, because we've got, like, what, 8 takes, so it's just easy to pick our hero takes in. These are the ones we wanted.
Yeah.
We wrote it down on the day. Last take of that, fourth take of that, third of that.
Print takes, really.
Print takes. Take it into Red Alert and just go, you know what? Not only do I want you to output these clips, but pay attention to the in and out points I bothered setting in Red Alert. It goes, yeah, no problem. And it just pumps out full DPX files, and that's it. We just, like, we didn't have to offline it because, quite frankly, if you've got HD files uncompressed, we can happily edit those and just finish the job. So it works in both worlds. It works in the world where you know what you're doing and you just want to bulk transfer some stuff, and it also works in the world of being a path in the offline process. Now, Monkey Extract and Red Rushes can be conceptually leaped in the same zone, right?
Yeah.
But Red Rushes, and this is really important, does not have EDL input. If it had the ability to read XMLs and EDLs and all that kind of stuff, then why would you need Monkey Extract? You wouldn't. But Monkey Extract works on the Avid workflow because you need to be able to give out something that a computer can access the R3Ds and read.
Right.
Red Rushes isn't that thing.
Okay.
Okay, yeah. So those two kind of lump together, but they're not the same thing. Metacheater, to a certain extent, Automatic Dark and MetaFuse, you can think of as being more ingesty kind of issues. Though, again, they're not equivalent. And then the original Crimson, of course, to also solve the workback problem. And in this process, we're generally trying to work above straight EDLs, because EDLs are quite simple. And so you'll hear us talking about different, like OMF and AFF and of course, the Avid ALE. And all of these are sometimes just colloquially referred to as EDLs, but we actually don't mean that at all, because an EDL is quite a stupid thing from stupid days with stupid switches before the days of computers. I mean, I don't think Steve Jobs even had a TV when they invented EDLs. It was like CMX300. And so we're trying to get away from that. Now, all of that has this... You have to listen to part 4 next week, because in part 4 next week we'll discuss how you can use things like Wiretap Central and, to a certain extent, MetaFuse to avoid having to do that at all, because you can just read the files directly. In fact, for example, in this process with the offline, I might send the ALE file from Avid to some other box, like one of the new ones that can actually read R3D files. And so it'll effectively, I'm using the slang now, take in the EDL from the Avid cut and just access the goddamn R3Ds itself. It doesn't need to do any kind of Monkey Extract or have had Red Rushes used or anything else like that.
Yeah.
But that's all sort of happening now, as opposed to even happening 3 months ago.
Yeah, because you don't want to have to start then in the other step, start creating a sort of overlength with handles exported bunch of DPXs. You really want to be able to just take and send an EDL and a hard drive to your online or your grader or whatever and go from there.
Yeah. And I should also say that what I've tried to cover is the big players.
Yeah.
Even though some of these companies may sound small, they are the players that come up again and again and again. Now, there are other companies starting to produce new stuff. Almost every week we'll get an email. I've got one this week I can't talk about. Somebody's come up with something really cool. It's in beta. So this is changing, but these are all solid companies.
The words really cool will not apply until you're able to just, Avid is able to just, here's my drive, look at it, drag them in.
Well, it's sort of doing that with Metafuse.
We're getting there, but there's still a lot of steps. I'm not even the person that has to do any of these steps, and I still think it's crazy.
Well, but I kind of argue with you that it's crazy on film. It just is that you never cared about it because it always worked.
Yes, when you step back and you explain the whole film workflow, I think, geez, that's pretty shitty as well, all of those steps. You know, the cutting in egg and all that sort of stuff. It is pretty crazy, but we were used to it.
Yeah, exactly.
Everyone knew what they were doing. They'd been doing it for 40, 50 years or whatever.
So my thing is that it's moved now from being a nightmare and to being totally doable. The trouble is that a bunch of people have yet to had enough time with this to just know it inside out. So if you're one of the people that knows it inside out, you could, like we did on Red Dwarf, just worked great, brilliant, just all happened like it should.
Yeah,
no hassles, right? But you get somebody that doesn't know that, who just puts their hand up and says, well, how hard can it be? And you, well, actually quite a large learning curve, seriously, you know. But not because of lack of trying. And so, you know, as you say, it is getting simpler and changing. But
yeah, it can be simpler.
If Avid
didn't
have its own proprietary DNX HD format.
Yeah.
And quite frankly,
and if Red didn't have its own proprietary
format,
yeah. But that's, you know, the double-edged sword. That's the beauty and the beast.
But there is no reason you couldn't edit in Avid, and there's no reason that you couldn't do your own thing in Final Cut and be really simple. But do your own thing in Avid and be really simple? Not quite.
Yeah, yeah. Once you get into your stride of doing it, as you were on that show, you know, day after day, and you get into the stride of it, it's a lot easier than people are doing the one-off, you know, commercials. Next week they're doing 35, and then last week they were doing, you know, SR from Genesis or whatever, and, you know, it's that when you're not doing it all the time that makes it quite hard as an editing house. It's, okay, this week everyone's going to have sit down and okay, what's the state of the union this week? What's the best, the least painful way of doing to this week's job? So I think the less steps, and obviously it will happen, the less steps are going to make it easier for those houses that have to go, you know, are not doing Red every single week. They're doing something different. Every job is a completely different thing. You don't have to relearn every time, you know, a new director for that particular job walks through the door.
The only thing I'll say is when you go behind the scenes of almost anything, like the first, and I'm using this as a segue into our next interview, but when I first heard about the workflow on Slumdog Millionaire, it seemed pretty easy. You know, and the cameras looked really small and tiny.
Absolutely.
And it looked like, how hard could it be?
How hard could it be?
And they were shooting, you know, they shot about, 60% of the film on as you'll hear in the interview, on digital.
Yeah.
A bit more than they expected. So that sounded good. Did more than they expected. Cut, you know, got to be pretty simple.
Absolutely.
And then you go behind the scenes.
Yeah. Just grab an SI2K and, you know, hey, just put some sort of recorder in your backpack or whatever, off you go.
And
a little bum bag,
and
surely.
A gyroscope. And,
absolutely. But then when you sort of, as obviously we'll sort of allude to.
So we're very proud to be able to have an interview with Anthony Dodd-Mantle, who's here for the National Awards at the Australian Cinematographer Society, which happened this weekend in Queensland. It was a full weekend of excellent national awards, as well as interesting lectures and talks and Q&A series. And also, Jason, for those people that are in Sydney, that was up in Queensland, there's actually a screening of Slumdog Millionaire coming this Friday night at 5 p.m.
or fantastic. Rather,
actually 8:30, I think, at the Roxy Theatre at Screen Australia. That's open to members of the ACS and also by invitation to VES members. And they'll have a Q&A session as well, which I'm really looking forward to.
A Q&A in Sydney with Anthony.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Fantastic.
But let's cross now to that interview, which I did via phone to Anthony, who was recovering in Queensland from the weekend. thank you so much for joining us. We really do appreciate it.
Absolutely no problem. It's always a pleasure.
I was interested to talk to you at so many levels. Before even you did Slumdog, you were one of the first DOPs to shoot with the Red camera in the UK. What led you to that decision to use the Red? And has digital cinematography always been a passion for you?
Just do one thing first. As far as the Red is concerned, the Red camera, I contemplated actually, together with Danny, I contemplated using the Red at an early stage in relation to Slumdog Millionaire. It was in the air. We debated it, and Danny, it was much more on a superficial level. Danny had heard about something called the Red camera, and he'd heard me mumbling about the Red camera years ago. And then he said, now maybe it's time. He sent me a mail from India saying, while he was researching, and saying, you know, maybe this is the time, check it all out. And I had to write to him very quickly and say, well, for what you needed me to do in the slums, it was not going to be the Red camera. And I'll go into detail about that more later. But that said and done, I had been familiar with it and its development over the years, as I'm sure a lot of us were. And it just wasn't ready for that one. But what happened, so I went off and did Slumdog, and we'll talk about that later. I did that on what I did it on. But when I came back, towards the end of shooting Slumdog, the BBC got in touch with me. Kenny Branagh was acting in a kind of detective, of a Swedish detective story. They're great hits in Sweden, and massive hits in Sweden and Germany. And the BBC wanted to have them done for English TV. And Kenneth was going to star in it. And it was being shot like an hour away from my home in Copenhagen. So it was almost like coming home after India for 6 months and being close to my kids. So I said yes to that. And then we started talking formats. And it was literally only to be aired on TV, TXing. It was never going to go into cinema. And we had moved on a year in the Red, the history of the Red development by now. And so I started talking to the director about the Red, and I looked at the kind of shooting schedule, and I looked at the kind of ambition of the stories, and I also looked at the locations that were very small and stuff like that. And there was clearly going to be a pretty aggressive debate about whether we shot on film or digital. And when they started talking about digital, the BBC, who were involved, were just basically deadpan saying, well, of course, if you shoot on digital, we'd be very pleased, as producers say, we'd be very pleased if you shot on the D20, for example. Now, the D20, I've shot on before, and I love the fact that they developed that camera, Ari, and I think it was, at its time when it came out, a great camera, but a lot has happened since then, and which is why they made the D21 now, as you probably know. But I was kind of annoyed. Something happens to me inside when somebody tries to read. It's like when you read a script and some producer says, we're shooting it on digital and blah, blah, blah. And I find this really annoying, because I don't think that's the decision that should be made by the producer. I think, you know, when I used to read a script, I read a script, and then I'll talk to the director and the producers, of course, about what they think about it and what we think about it. And then something evolves out of that conversation, and you start to think about formats and lenses and all sorts of formats. And in the case of Valanda, which is what I shot with Kenny Branagh, it seemed appropriate to the director and I, certainly, that the Red would be an interesting way to go, because we were shooting in pokey small locations. I wouldn't be able to get my lights in easily and quickly and effectively on 3 or 4 locations a day. I'd have to light, obviously, but I wouldn't be able to light as well as I would normally do, and I wanted to take care of the faces and the highlights, but the shadows would be a problem, and I'm not the sort of DOP that just slams up the basic ambient light in an interior so it looks unreal, because then it doesn't look authentic. So I started testing the Red, and I started looking at sort of, you know, talking to everybody I knew on Earth who had anything to do with the Red, and felt that it was pretty appropriate. So I started talking to the BBC, and they initially, as I said, they said that I should shoot on the D20, and then they started actually indirectly, you have to quote me, I wouldn't say working against us, but they weren't very compliant and they weren't very helpful. And I had, fortunately, a very, very helpful line producer by the name of Mosley, what was his name? Mosley. He works a lot with Ken Branagh anyway, and he used to be an AD. He's very hands-on about cameras. Say if I'm speaking too fast, by the way, or digressing, but you're
no,
taking,
absolutely.
But this guy, Simon Mosley is his name, he was very keen for us to try. He was, first of all, as informants, he was very keen for us to get what we wanted. You know, if the DOP and the director were saying we'd like to go this way, he was very attentive and listened and didn't just back off on the pressure that was coming from the Beeb at the top, that we should use what they knew and what their workflow was appropriate for. And that's basically what the problem was about. They didn't have a workflow. Nobody had a workflow for the Red. And along comes Muggins, Dodd-Mantle, and a director who wants to play with the Red, and it means they have to sort of open up some new files and, you know, download some more stuff, and it sets panic in the labyrinth of behind the scenes BBC, I think. But anyway, to cut a long story short, we worked on it, we tested, and I really thought it looked damn good. And I was fortunate enough in Denmark to have a very close friend in Sweden, Jesper, who was on the top 50 names of the Red buyers. You know, he's been that basically what that means. He was I think he has Red Camera number 48 or something. He was one of the first. The first 10 or 20 are in the family, you know, and then they start going out to people in America being close to the development of the Red, and he's way up there, which means basically he's always believed in it, and he's worked very seriously around it and developed it, and he was a great help, and he was around me when I was doing the tests, and I trusted him, and we looked at the results, and I really saw nothing to worry about, and so I immediately start to think, okay, this is a camera. Apart from doing some good TV drama with good actors, this is exciting. You know, we're going to work with new technology and let's move the BBC onward, and they should thank us for that. But then you realize it's like pushing, you know, it's trying to push a dinosaur out of a cage at London Zoo, and the door's the size of a cat flap. It's like moving the BBC when they don't want to move themselves. However powerful or ever respectable they think you may be, it's just very, very, very tough.
Well, I certainly owe you a debt of gratitude, because I got camera number 22 and we just shot...
Have you really?
Yeah.
Well, I've talked to...
We just shot Red Dwarf in London, and it was obviously partly BBC, and we wouldn't have been able to do that had you not trailed a blazing path forward before us.
Well, thank God it helped.
Oh, it helped enormously. They couldn't have been more enthusiastic.
I'm so glad. And I don't know enough about you and what you do, so, you know, I don't know. But, I mean, I'm just so happy. But it was a nightmare. I don't know, this is going on tape. It was a nightmare because I didn't understand. Suddenly, the way it worked was, you'd feel you were moving forward. We'd do our tests. We'd look at them, the director, the DOP, you know, our producers over there in Sweden, and Jesper, who was his expert from Sweden. We'd all look at it, and I didn't know enough about cinema to sort of, certainly, for, you know, when you're TXing on television, to know whether I felt comfortable or not with it. And I was obviously hunting for artifacts and all the things that you do here about as well, new formats. And I was interested in the workflow, getting that nailed down as soon as possible, because that is a big issue.
Mm.
But all that I took very, very seriously, and I also took BBC's concern, or concern, very seriously about whether they could get the workflow to work, because that is essential. It's no point in just avoiding that or ignoring it. But that said and done, the results were interesting, and I took some of the stuff to the farm in London. I don't really know the people at the farm. They work a lot with the Beeb.
Mm-hmm.
I forget the name of the guy, the grader who'd worked with Philip Martin before, but he's used to sort of sticking all sorts of electronic image, digitally captured imagery into his grader, you know, knocking it around and seeing how it performs. He looks at all the waveforms. He can see how the areas are behaving, the colours, and he was impressed and said, this is great, you know, I can make this work. All the time he got like good positive reactions from creative people and technically knowledgeable people, and then a mail will come back like 3 days later saying, have you tested this or have you tested that from the BBC? And it was basically bloody rude, because they weren't even respecting the people we had over there, and were light years ahead of them in knowledge. And it became clear to me the BBC were, to a certain extent, these technical guys were actually using us to learn about it, because they didn't know anything about it. They were just basically behind and rusted into a position of not knowing, you know what I mean? And
yeah, well, ironically...
That was very much the case.
They couldn't have been more supportive of us, so they clearly you've done a lot of good.
Well, thank God for that, because some kind of decision came out after we'd made Verlander that they would not be officially producing, as yet, Red Productions. And I don't know when you shot and produced your piece of work. Was that last year?
This year, it was literally went to air at Easter.
All right. Well, certainly last year, like after we came through with our material, which would, and we were going into post-phasing in summer last year, at that time, the official announcement of the BBC was they would not be doing any more Red at present, because they weren't ready yet and they wanted to get things sorted out. And they were pinpointing certain artifacts in our material, but when I say that, they were like literally blowing the image up, you know, and going into the far right-hand corner. And if you do that on any material, you can find you know, you can find the grain, or you can find the, you can find artifacts, certainly in digital imagery. So I thought they're a bit tough. So I'm very, very happy to hear that.
Well,
but so basically, we got it. You know, we got. I have to say that under a week before we started shooting, they finally officially approved us. But up to a week before shooting, where everything was ready to go, actors and so on, and I was doing my tests and I was ready to know how to light these films and do my lighting packages and so on. Up to a week before, I still didn't know whether they were approving it. They were teasing or being annoying. Well, we went, and they've done well. They've got the BAFTA now, so.
Well, obviously, you don't shoot digital just for its own sake. You do it because it gives you something. And I guess my question is, what did it give you? What was the thing that promoted you to go to the SI2K and on Slumdog? Because what was the sort of driving thing for that?
Well, like I said, just briefly, Verlander was about shooting in very small locations in Sweden and being able to heave up the shadows and the dark areas and keep them solid, do you know what I mean? And then light for the faces and hold the highlights. As far as India was concerned, on my first research trip to India, I just looked at the slums and looked at the kind of places where I'd be shooting with Danny, and I knew that latitude was going to be a problem. I would have preferred to shoot on film. Then I took a walk down some of the streets, well, I can't call them streets, but the sort of gullies and the corridors of the slums that I was going to shoot in Slumdog Millionaire. And I realized, actually, as Danny was correct and suspecting that because of improvisation reasons, because of the kids who weren't actors, because of the space and because of the highly irrational circumstances around shooting on location in India, it would have been advisable us to shoot for cost reasons. Those slum scenes were highly improvised on digital because it would save us some money. We'd be able to shoot more and be able to work in a different way. And there were lots of different theories he had about us being more invisible, which I don't believe in, or certainly I understand the economic thing. So the slum shooting of India, which is officially about 25% of the film, that was always going to be digital. And I had to go down and solve that. And at that point in time, I did not know about the SR2K, but I came back from the first slum recce realizing I had to find something damn quick. And I did not want to go down there with prosumer tools like the Canon XL2 that I'd worked with the Canon on 28 Days Later with Danny. And, of course, the producers had seen that box heavily in America and Europe, and they made a lot of money. And they kind of would hope that Danny and I would shoot Slumdog, the digital part of Slumdog, that I'd do that in the same way, just shoot on this Canon, because Anthony had done it before and Danny had done it before, and that worked well, and they made money, and, you know, so what's all the fuss about? Just go do that again. And that's all fine, but that's where the other kind of phase in, the other kind of aspect of my work is I don't really want to go down the same road again if for the sake of it. Anyway, I prefer to find something better, and I, you know, it's 4 or 5 years ago since we shot 28 Days Later, and technology has moved on, and I knew that I could get him something better for India, and certainly the contrast ratios were different in India. In England on 28 Days Later, I could control a lot more, and the contrast was never as bad as it was in India. So I started looking at other cameras. I considered the Red, but it wasn't ready. It wasn't physically ready either. It's still too big and heavy for what I had to do. And then I got a tip about these mini cameras in Germany, so I got hold of some information about these kind of mini cameras that were small blocks that you put, with a PO mount, you could put lenses onto, and then you feed it off into discs or hard disks or whatever. And I did some tests with that, and it was interesting. And I took these cameras down to India, and I tried to shoot it onto what do they call those massive Sony tape decks?
SRX?
Venoms? No, what are they
right.
called?
Right, the Venom pack?
Yeah, and that was great. It was all right, and the quality of the image was really good, but it was bloody expensive, and we'd have to buy them. They didn't have them in India. We would have to buy them. We'd have to buy two. It was very heavy, very weighty. There were still heat issues with the mechanism, but it was actually a way I was thinking of going. We did tests on it and it looked good, but even the rental of that equipment was too expensive. And then we delivered some potential cost assessments of what it would cost us to shoot the film on that with four units working and so on. And the producers panicked, especially coming from a starting block of thinking we were going to shoot on the XL1s or XL2 Canons or prosumer gear. So I had to go back to the drawing board very quickly, and Danny was by this time wrecking down in India and saying, you're getting there, and I was saying, yeah, we're getting there, Danny, and we weren't there. And then I discovered the SR2Ks. Stefan Chupik, who's been a very close collaborator with me and supporter and an HD expert, he and I had a few chats with some people about the SR2Ks, and we decided to work with them. So we got hold of a company called Pillar Film in Germany, who were down in Wiesbaden, and they are a lovely small company who are very good hands-on creative people, scientific, artistic, very interesting people. And we started to work on the SI2K, the idea of breaking the back off, you know, just using the front end, the block. My main mission was to find a way of hammering down those small lanes of the slums, which you've now seen in the film, and being able to do it physically without taking up too much space, and being able to shoot as high quality images as possible. So these cameras could record 2K, and they could record with CMOS chip technology, which I like, which is the same as the Red, but I like that chip. I could put the lenses of my choice on this block because it was a PL mount, so there's a large choice of lenses to choose from. And I was looking for flare, but I was looking for good lenses. So I was, you know, looking at a whole set of older lenses like the Cooks from the 60s and the 70s. And I was also looking at higher end lenses that were more modern but were very heavy.
Were you on zooms because you needed to be that flexible, or you
wanted? I had zooms as well. Yeah. I had zooms as well. What I finally ended up doing was, you know, so we went with the SI2K. We tested. We were still testing prototypes when we started shooting in pre-production period. We started shooting. I still needed two more weeks of testing, but Danny wanted to go, so we started working with him, and it was a nightmare for me. But we worked, and he was sympathetic to the fact we were still testing. But we were actually shooting the film in our pre-production period, and to get it done, and we were in there. And I eventually got four units. I had them calibrated and configured in Germany, so that I had special rigs made. I had brackets made to put gyros underneath them, so I could do like a weird kind of camera movement that was between handheld and Steadicam. It had the smoothness of Steadicam, but I could make certain erratic stops and angle movements as a handheld.
I've seen that rig and it looks terrific, but what's not normally shown in those photos is there's a cable leaving off to the left of the shot, and that
Where did that cable go?
Yes, and that actually went round to a backpack, right?
Yeah, so I've got a backpack on the back. In the backpack, I have a MacBook Pro, you know, top-end model with the processor that could drive, you know, drive the material, could process it. And I flipped the lids. I didn't do this personally. I got the guys to flip the lids of the MacBook Pro computer so that the screen was facing outward. And I got that built into a hard case on my back so that you actually had a screen so you could play back with a little mouse. And you know, we rigged it all up. So in this suitcase on my back, not camouflage. I didn't want it to look camouflage anonymous. I just wanted to, yeah, anonymous is the word. I just wanted it to look like, I didn't look like too, here I come with a movie camera kind of thing.
Right.
I kind of held the thing very nonchalantly. Often I was shooting and just pointing it at people and not looking, you know. I had the small block and it looked trashy. I had all the advertisement names, all the names that looked like film cameras. I had them peeled off or taped off. So it looked a bit more anonymous. I wasn't trying to hide. I just didn't want to attract too much attention. And then as you said, the cable goes into the back and it goes into this computer, and you've got the MacBook processing the imagery. And we had buffer problems, but that's basically going into hard disks, flash disks that we're recording. And then in that suitcase, also very soon we discovered, because of the heat problems, we had to have little plastic containers with dry ice loaded in and changed like every hour, because the fucking things were... I tested them in Germany in saunas, but when we got down to the slums and that heat and the sun, they were just boiling over after an hour, sometimes after half an hour, sometimes after 10 minutes. So we had a whole team of Indians bringing dry ice onto set every morning and loading it into this state-of-the-art little rucksack with all this stuff for these computers and this... It was extraordinary.
Wow.
Very extraordinary.
Now, what you sort of had about, what, you thought about 11 stops latitude on that, and what were you rating there?
Yeah, I would say around about that. It's hard to say precisely. That didn't govern, whether it would have been 11 or 11 and a half, that didn't govern my decision to use them. It was actually the look, but it was the tolerance, yeah. It was about latitude. It was about, I would say, around about 11 stops. And particularly what I like about the SI2K, which is still a faltering point on the Red, is the SI2K held the highlights very well. Okay. Not as courageous and as robust in the black in the low end, as you will know from shooting the Red, as the Red is. But certainly on the highlights, I could, to combine with filters and being careful with the skies, I could hold, because you know when you go into grading, you know if you haven't got any information, whether it's digital or not, if you haven't got any information, you haven't got any information, then you can't do anything with it. If it's lost, it's lost. And I try to keep the skies as much as I can.
But were you sort of rating the camera at? I mean, I presume it wasn't sort of get out the light meter type environment. But
No. I mean, I tested obviously very thoroughly, but I reckon I was rating the SI2K around between 200 and 250.
Right.
I reckon around about 200.
And And was there anything particular about the sensor that you felt like was much better in tungsten or daylight? Or I guess you were just shooting in natural light.
Yeah, I'm going back now. I shot a lot. I lit a lot, and I was lighting the slums as well in gaps when you fly by. You know, and there are obviously some areas that are available where it was the biggest demand, you know, for the chip. But I recollect that with the SR2K now, correct me if I'm wrong, have you shot with the SR2K yourself?
Only in tests. I've not done a proper project.
Okay, well, I recollect that we had issues with the blue light. There's something about the color matrix that it reacts very strongly to the blue layer. And if you go into like heavy tungsten areas, there's something about it with the red camera as well. Have you experienced this with the red camera?
Yeah, absolutely. With the red, it's definitely much, much better in daylight.
In blue. Exactly, in day or in, you know, 5-6, yeah, exactly. Well, there was the same thing going on with it. Was slightly different, but there was certain problems, and I forgive me that I can't precisely say that's not what you want to hear in an interview like this.
No, that's right. You're on a 2/3 inch sensor, but with a PL mount, right? So what was the depth of field like? Was that adequate for what you wanted?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I had good pullers, you know, and I, quite honestly, the less depth of field, the better. I was very happy with it. I love the way it falls away into hot, sort of out of focus backgrounds and stuff like that. And I use a lot of lenses on Slumdog, particularly in the slums where there's a slight violence to the imagery. I use a lot of lenses where I use very wide lenses and focus very close. I use macros as well. I place cameras sometimes in sequences where they're just focused on something in the foreground, like inches away from the lens, and then there's movement in the background, people flying by. Number one, it's good for not recognizing people looking in the camera, but it looks organic, you know. Number two, you don't see people staying. You can't see if they're in costume or they're wearing adverts, you know, graphic things you have to paint out afterwards. So I use a lot of close focus stuff in slightly mildly uncontrollable social situations.
Now, whether it was digital or film, I didn't care. One of the things I loved in this film, I just loved the scenes when you broke out or the kids broke out and ended up on the train. Can you tell me how you kind of dealt with that? Because that was just, I just felt like, you know, cinematically, it was a breath of fresh air that exactly mirrored the plot line of the story, which I just thought was beautiful.
Is that when they escape?
Yeah.
Is that when they escape from the kids, when they're blinding, or is it when...
They're out on the train and they start travelling the trains and stealing stuff through the
montage,
windows.
Yeah, it's lovely, yeah. It's a mixture. I mean, like you said, it's a mix. I won't say every single scene, but most scenes in Slumdog are a mixture of 35 and digital stills and SR2K. They are a mixture, and the first scene is quite different. The first two scenes in the film are SR2K, so the audience settles into a look very quickly, and they're very saturated, which is the yellow scenes and the torture. It's not what you asked. I just want to tell you that tactically I was careful about how I used the cameras. I mean, I chose film or digital by as a gut feeling, really. I knew I was going to shoot the slums on digital, and a kind of logical mathematics developed during the shooting of Slumdog for what scenes we shot what. But I still changed cameras and often shot elements on film and on digital, you know, within scenes, and I'm very happy for that. It didn't bother you. But the kids on the train, I mean, when they actually escaped from the Blinding Institute, we've just come from a whole sequence of day for night and night for night on film, pushed one stop. So I'm shooting everything around about 1,000 ASA because I'm marrying the film stock as best I can off to the slightly different look of the SR2K. But when they break out and run for the train, that's again a mixture of film, long lenses, prime lenses, Cooks, and SR2K lenses and wide angles, and even lipstick cameras cut in there sometimes, you know. So it's very varying formats all the time going out. But then they get on the train and you're in these trains with these kids, and you just want them to forget about you, so they're just running around looping their action and selling sweets and, you know, stealing and all that kind of stuff. And I just tried to camouflage myself off into, I mean, there were sets. They weren't civilian people who we were traveling on public trains. They were sets where we had control of the people. I'm not implying that we were shooting documentary there, but even then it's very difficult, as you probably know, shooting in trains, space. And I could hide and rig cameras in all sorts of areas, different kind of slightly uncomfortable camera positions. So it felt, I wouldn't say the word documentary, but it felt kind of hyper-real. Because when you travel in trains in India, there are so many people. There are so many people. You're touched and pushed all the time by people because they're so close to you. There's so many people. And I tried to get that kind of crowdedness and rather animal kind of animal house feeling of some of those trains.
I think it's a cultural thing. I think that if you're in a country like India, and I mean this with all respect, the people are quite comfortable to be closer together, if that makes sense.
And sleep on your shoulder, basically. Yeah,
yeah. And
I've fallen asleep, you know, in 79, I was in India for a year, and I travelled a lot there. And I was one time in such a crowded train for 2 days and 2 days and two nights, and I gave up burrowing my way through a corridor. I was crawling on people's heads. I'm not kidding. I was crawling on people's heads, pushing my rucksack in front down the corridor to get into my compartment that me, the Brit, had reserved. And then I realized when I got there that it had been overtaken by the military and they weren't going to give their seat up for me. And I just sort of, I remember slumping down onto the floor amidst all these people next to the loos. And this little Indian girl, I remember, who was being held by her mum, she was so scared she peed on me. And I thought I was sweating. And I'll never forget this. This is a long time back in my life, but it tells you how crowded it is in there. I felt this water on my face, on my lips, and I tasted it, and it was salt. And I just felt I was bursting into a sweat because I was slightly desperate and exhausted. And I looked up, and I realized it was a little girl who was so scared. I was so close to her, but she was scared, and her mum saw it, and she peed down her leg and peed on me. And I couldn't move my head. That's how crowded it can get on trains. Can you imagine that?
And yet, for the dislocation that it is.
Sidetrack, yeah.
Well, no, but I was going to say, like, it's you obviously have an empathy for the country because it's both it's both startling, comforting, cruel, and frightening. I mean, the film does cover a huge dramatic range, which of course lends it, because from the what I found to be breathtakingly, you know, breath of fresh air of the kids being out of the slums, there were all sorts of scenes you had to deal with, from TV studios to torture scenes. It was a huge dynamic range of
kaleidoscope. And I mean, India, I don't know you've been in, but India is a kaleidoscope, and it takes you to many, many mental, spiritual places, good and bad. It's
and noisy.
Yeah, it's noisy. It's horrific. It's unforgettable, and it's adorable, and it's absolutely enigmatic, and it's petrifying. And that's what life is. And I think people are calling this film a feel-good film. It's not. It's a feel film. It is a feel-good film because the storyline ends good and they get what they want, blah, blah, blah. But I think by the time you come out and you're smiling and feeling quite lightweight and happy about it, you have had imprinted on your mind, on your brain and your eyesight, a lot of images of something telling you something very different to that, something very much the opposite.
Absolutely. I wouldn't have called it a feel-good film. But I would...
But some people are. A lot of people are. You know?
Right.
No, I don't agree. I think it's a feel film. I don't think it's a feel-good film. But even some of the producers are calling it a feel-good film. And they've even had the word feel-good film in their PR, which they control. And I was much in disagreement about that. I didn't like that at all.
Logistically, how did you cope with rushes, be the digital or whatever? I mean, were you getting a lot of feedback on the ground, or were you having to sort of batch that up to look at what you'd shot?
Under great pressure, I had to try and find a lab in India to work. So as far as the film, you know, 40% of the film is shot on celluloid. I chose a lab, the Kodak lab, which is a very small lab in Bombay, and not used by me, but used for commercials, but not used by many. But Solomon, who was the leader of the lab, I liked very much, and I relied very much on my second unit operator, who was very trustworthy and who was a neighbor to the lab. So he helped me, as far as my rushes were concerned, he helped me with my testing, and he helped me with this, I wouldn't say daily contact, but sometimes we had 14, 15-hour days, and I just couldn't do a two-hour journey up to a lab. But he'd pop by and talk to the guys and see if I needed personal contact. But I did sort of like stick tests, you know, strip tests every now and then with the lab just to keep them awake. And I watched them. I did push a lot, which no lab wants to do, but I used the lab there. And then, you know, if I pushed, it had to wait a day or two. But otherwise, if I just did normal exposure, then in principle, we could get our stuff down to a place called Pixion, which is actually quite a high-end, state-of-the-art
house
in Mumbai.
Yeah, they're a good place.
They are very good people, but I had to really fight to get them because they had originally, again, about a week before shooting and while we were shooting, they were sending me around to other post houses where I was walking through. I was looking at spirit scanners where they were building the building next door, and the glass doors weren't even shut, and they were scanning and transferring.
Whereas Pixion's like
Pixion
very modern.
It should be.
Yeah,
Pixion, I wouldn't mind if it was old, but I just like hygiene and cleanliness, because, I mean, for fuck's sake. And I was being shown around by these people who were looking at me as a client, and there was just dust and building going on. I thought, and then I found Pixion, and I felt safe there, and it was more expensive, and I had to fight for that with the producers. We got that, and that was dealing with our rushes and our, you know, our DVDs that came back into the Avid, and I kind of gave them a few indications of a look of how I wanted things. As far as our SR2K material is concerned, that was then backed up in three places. As you know, we had terabyte massive servers backing up as well, but we backed up in two places. Some of the stuff went back to England, but we basically pumped it back into the AVID, as you know, and then they did their the DVDs out of the AVID, and I gave them guidelines for the looks so that the editor could simulate that. So it was pretty, I would say, it would be an interesting conversation to have with Chris Dickens, the editor, but it was a very heavy production as regards back-end turnover, turning around rushes. It was big. We had a lot of people employed doing it, and it was a big cost issue, and it was much more than the and Danny needs to see his stuff, and I need to see my stuff. I saw everything. And we shot a lot of material. Sometimes we shot 4 hours, you know, a day, and it was a lot of material.
But I guess so, that mobility really paid for you in terms of the, because also it was at the a child's, you know, it was the child's point of view from a story point of view.
Absolutely. So I mean, I could experiment more. You know, you get more brave. I could go off and shoot things in the streets and send my guys off and take a chance and send them back again if it wasn't good enough, and send them back three times, four times sometimes. And I also sent film cameras out sometimes, you know, even though it was second unit. If I was seeing a shot that I wanted up from the top of the building that I'd seen and scouted, I'd send them out with a BL or an LT or an ARRI instead, because it's easier sometimes to carry a single camera and a physical celluloid, you know, because the SR2K was still pretty complicated for the certain union crew. They'd never seen anything like that. And most of the people that were with me from Europe, it was only the closest to me that had had anything to do with this before. They weren't terrified. It was pretty state-of-the-art stuff. But, I mean, that said and done, you know, it was obviously a very good decision. Ironically, when we started with the slums, Danny, as a director, fell in love with the kind of operating that I could do with that gyro, and he got fascinated by it. He felt it was more personal. He felt he was getting more of me, and he felt that I was getting more of the story in India. So he found he uses the word boring, it's a bit hard, but he found a lot of the material that was shot on celluloid boring compared to it. So that meant I had to reevaluate my plans, as you have to as a DOP, and think again about why I was doing some of the scenes which I had expected to shoot on film. But I went with him, and we trusted each other, and I followed my gut. And certainly, as your question implies, if having digital camera like that and sourcing, even though there was a massive turnaround of material and it was a big job for the editors to sort through and sift through it all in the bins, you know, I could take more chances with kids that knew really very little about filmmaking and didn't know that I was filming. When you get a film camera out in 35, you're going to need a slate and you're going to need discipline, and it costs a lot of money. So you're going to start taking charge and insisting on control of young kids. When you're shooting the SR2K, I can tease them a bit and pretend I'm shooting sometimes when I'm not. And then when we finish the take, I say, oh, we got that. And they start standing around and talking and I start filming. Do you know what I mean?
I've
done a lot of that before in documentary, you know.
When that scene, the famous, you know, in that they were out of the rain and the third musketeer first joins them. Getting those performances out of those children in those conditions.
That's actually film. It's interesting. That is actually all pushed. That's pushed. That's the fastest stock I had, push one stock, Fuji.
But you must have had a small crew, because it just didn't feel like you could have got that with a lot of carry-on around them.
I think certainly you mustn't have too much carry-on. You can't mark them up too much, you know, and have... You've got to. It's about the type of people you have on your crew as well. And I don't necessarily think it's always true to have as few people as possible, because then you get all sweaty under the arms because you're carrying too much and working too hard and you get irritable. I think it's about having the right people around. And obviously nobody irrelevant should be there, but having the right people around and radiating the right energy. And I think kids feel safe very quickly if you do that. And I think sometimes you know, potential Oscar-winning professional actors are as childlike and as much like kids as kids themselves. I think even professional actors need... They are the sensibilities have to be respected, you know, because they're in a zone where they have to be left alone, but they want to feel loved or feel respected by you. And I think it's very important, if I'm not operating myself, that, you know, the kind of people I employ, apart from the good operators, they have to be people I like or potentially love, you know what I mean? I really think the energy around the camera is essential. But ironically, that scene with that torrential rain and then the building yard there, that was film. But we were still, you're right, we were discreet and quiet. And by that time, they knew us. We were probably 6 weeks into shooting then, so they knew us well.
I mean, that was one of the most emotionally strong scenes for me, not because of the dialogue, but because of
the visuals and the rain. It's pouring down, the wet and the cold, and it was cold for them. And
And of course, what
and also it's not overlit. You know, I didn't overlight that. I tried to. Looking at that material, I had to. I was feeling it maybe you do things like it doesn't look like shit, but I was pretty worried because I was pushing 800 to 1,000. I wasn't kick lighting. I wasn't rimming, so I couldn't separate them off. And I thought I was worried about it, and I had to noise reduce in the post and work with it. But at the same time, I knew that it would give a reality to it. You really feel cold there when the camera pans across their bodies and they're lying there and they just told each other what their name is, and it's raining and you see that rain pouring down.
Can you remember what that was lensed on?
Sorry?
Can you remember what lenses you had on that? Like,
I shot in that I would have been shooting, let me see now, I would have been shooting Zeiss 2.1s in there, I reckon.
Right.
I reckon so.
Well, as I say, I think it was just a beautiful piece of acting and cinematography. It was just all worked for me. That was probably the aha moment for me when I was just like, oh my God, this is going to be...
It's one of my favourite scenes. I'm glad you like that.
And
also the Oscars, when they asked me to choose scenes, I chose that scene. And they didn't take it, but I chose it. I also chose the poop scene, because I thought it would be great if we're going for the Oscars. have kids falling in poop behind Danny as he went up to his Oscar. And they didn't, unfortunately, take it. No, they took the same old mainstream stuff. But I had one of my five favourite scenes was that rain scene. I'm glad you like that.
So you were talking over the weekend with the National Awards, and I believe you've got a screening this Friday night in Sydney.
Yeah, that's right. I'm here in. I'm a bit gobsmacked about all this because I've never been here before. But I'm screening tonight in an hour or so in Brisbane, and I'm screening tomorrow night in Melbourne, and I'm screening the following night in Adelaide.
That would be Wednesday in Adelaide, Tuesday in Melbourne. Yeah.
Yeah, and then I'm coming to you on Thursday and Friday in Sydney.
I believe it's the 8th in Sydney.
Yeah.
And certainly I'll be there, so I look forward to
good.
To seeing you there. Thank you so much for taking time.
I hope this is usable for you. I mean,
absolutely.
Don't want to bomb, and please come up and say hello.
I definitely will, and thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. We really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. All right. Take good care now.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Thanks for doing that, Mike. Fantastic. Fantastic opportunity. Great interview. Thank you to Anthony for taking the time as well. That was brilliant. Really appreciate it. Now, there's a whole bunch of information on some press releases from Silicon Imaging on this, and photos in the show notes and on links of the Slumdog rig. Now, previously I'd shown this rig, and as we said, Mike, it was all pretty easy to imagine running across rooftops of Mumbai with this little rig, but when you actually sort of see the shots of what he was carrying in his backpack, it's quite staggeringly horrible how he managed to chuck a whole MacBook Pro and drives and battery and in a suitcase in a backpack. So there's shots of that, and obviously also shots of the rig and some on-set shots. Well worth a look, and there's a little bit more of a backstory as well in the production, and also obviously taking SI really into production with this production, really, because theoretically they were essentially working with near prototypes.
Well, now we've run horribly over time, so we just want to quickly finish up with gear, and we've been looking at just one piece of gear that I wanted to quickly mention. We'll put off some stuff till next week, but just as you know, with the Red camera, we tend to pummel it on our FireWire 800, and that can be sometimes a pain in the butt, not only because of speeds, but because of the fact that you've got not everything has FireWire 800 ports and stuff. And CoolCameraGear.com has come out with a really cool cable which will basically connect up the drives off your Red camera to eSATA, which basically means you've got an eSATA card in your Mac, which I've got one of. And
right.
You plug it in, and then you can plug in and transfer from the drives directly via eSATA, which is just a tremendous thing, and make stuff really, really quick and easy. And you know, it's a well-made cable. It's $230.
Yeah.
It's just feels like pro gear.
Yeah.
I believe it's even got some, you know, stuff in there to stop, like the quality of the cable is like specially done to kind of improve.
Yeah, this is not just something that you buy from Radio Shack. This is just designed to have.
It kind
you
of
know,
amazes me how people multiple. Don't spend enough money on things like cables and card readers and stuff when
yeah.
it's just your material.
Yeah, particularly, you know, eSATA, which is, you know, not probably, it's kind of like HDMI in its sort of horribleness of sort of beautifully, doesn't really mate all that well in my book. It's kind of like FireWire 800 is quite a horrible little plug. Whoever designed it should be first up against the wall. Yeah, so definitely, I mean, in terms of stuff like this, you just can't not, you can't scrimp on, you know, which is kind of mission critical stuff, really.
Well, yeah, because sometimes I look at this stuff and go, well, I'm just not going to put that in a rental box. I'm just, it's not reliable.
No, it's not going to last.
It's going to be bent and broken in 2 seconds.
Yeah.
And I found that with the HDMI stuff, that you'd look at it and you'd go, this is just home video stuff. This is not, you know, good professional quality stuff. But this stuff's great. This stuff from, I think I'll put a link in the show notes, but it's coolcameragear.com.
What if it works the other way? Can you actually plug it into the camera and then put it onto another eSATA drive? Or does the drive have to actually be proprietary? I.e., can you use it to...
I've not put a different eSATA drive on my RED. I've used it to...
Yeah.
Mainly because of the form factor and the fact that it fits in the slots and we've got quick releases and everything else. I hadn't thought to run different drives on my RED camera.
Sorry, questions without notice there, Mike.
But, yes. So, anyway, that's at coolgear.com. Anyway, so sorry to run so over time. We do apologize.
Thank you.
Keep your questions coming. We'll try and answer a few each week. We might have to do a whole show maybe at the end of our four-part on just Q&A, just to chew up... ones that we haven't got round to. There are some great questions we didn't get time to. We'll try and get through next week to do with Sony F900s and stuff. But until then, I'm Mike Seymour.
I'm Jason Wingrove. Thanks, guys, for listening.
See you guys later. Bye.
Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments, please email us, red@fxguide.com. Copyright 2008 FX Guide, LLC.